BBC World Service. This is Roger Hearing with NewsHour. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, mayhem and rioting on the streets of Athens. Three people die as a bank is set on fire in protest at savage cuts in public spending, which even government supporters don't like.
It's fully understandable that they're not happy with it. My government is not happy. We do not have an alternative.
Also, the security lapses that almost let the man accused of the New York attempted bombing escape. And if electric cars have to be noisy to be safe, what should they sound like? A Ferrari or a waterfall? You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Roger Hearing with NewsHour. Well, the upheavals over Greece's financial crisis turned nasty today. Amid riots in Athens, three people died when a bank was set on fire by protesters angry at government plans to bring in severe cuts in public spending. The cuts are part of a deal to give Greece a massive international financial bailout. The country's crippled by massive debts. But the anger on the streets was very apparent as the country underwent a general strike. Petrol bombs were hurled at police, who responded with pepper spray and tear gas. One person who was in amongst all that is Philip Pangalos, a reporter for Britain's Sunday Times newspaper. Philip, you were, I gather, quite near the scene when that bank was set on fire.
I was indeed. I was in the centre of Athens all day today for the today's demonstrations, which unfortunately turned very nasty today. I've been here for best part of 13 years. I've seen a lot of demonstrations. I've seen bigger demonstrations. I've seen more destructive demonstrations. But obviously, the tragic death toll of three people, including what I understand was a pregnant woman, is really very, very sad indeed. Yes, I was near the city centre. It was the whole centre was covered with debris from broken bricks, bits of marble, things that had been basically thrown at the riot police. And I had seen smoke and I heard that a bank was on fire, so I went down to see. I got there as the final flames were being doused by fire engines and thick smoke was still billowing out of the building. But the whole area in the centre of Athens was actually, you could see the acrid smell of tear gas and smoke, very unpleasant, with lots of people coughing and, you know, eyes running, that sort of thing, including some tourists who were, you know, caught up in the city centre. There was actually a crowd outside at the time, bystanders and protesters, as well as a lot of journalists and photographers who were covering the event. And a lot of people were actually quite shocked, especially as we started to get the rumours that people had died, because we didn't know exactly what had happened.
Yeah, was it? I mean, some people were suggesting it was a firebomb that was being thrown at the police and went astray and hit the bank, or was it deliberately targeted?
I spoke to an eyewitness who was a young lady who works in a bookstore directly across the road from the bank, and she told me that a group had splintered off from the protesters. They used crowbars to smash the windows, and they threw in petrol bombs. So it was a deliberate arson attack on the bank. Now, I don't know why they attacked that particular bank. There could be all sorts of reasons. I don't want to jump to conclusions. Possibly because people were actually working in there, which is actually even worse when you think about it. Obviously, most people were on strike. Most banks were closed, so that might have outraged them. It's also, this particular bank is owned by, it was Marfin Egnatia Bank, to be specific, on Stadio Avenue, which is, as I say, a few hundred yards from Parliament Square. It's owned by Marfin Investment Group, which is the company that bought the troubled Olympic Airways last year. So I don't know if there's any connection. I don't want to start to any sort of conspiracy moves. But the people who threw it are extremists on the fringe of society. As I was saying to somebody earlier on, you don't go to a demonstration with petrol bombs, iron bars, rocks and stones, not if it's a peaceful demonstration. Now, there were lots of people at today's demonstration. There were tens of thousands of people. I've heard estimates there were 100,000. I don't know if that's true. The police were telling me 25,000. The vast majority of those people were genuine protesters. Their private sector, their public sector, there were teachers, there were students, but there were a lot of people who are aligned to political parties, and especially some of the left-wing parties. But some of those people, as unfortunately so often happens in Greece when we have regular demonstrations here, after all, they are proud of their democratic heritage and their freedom to express themselves, get infiltrated by young people. When I say young, I mean usually in their 20s, wearing hoods, scarves or crash helmets, and they are intent with clashing with police, smashing windows, because the whole city centre was smashed windows, graffiti, anti-establishment graffiti all over the place, and scenes of destruction.
Philip, thanks for that very much. Philip Pangalos there of the Sunday Times. Well, the deputy head of Greece's main public servants union, Ilias Fretakos of Adedi, said that despite these deaths, the strike action would continue.
Δυστυχώς, η σημερινή μεγαλειώδης απεργιακή κινητοποίηση.
Unfortunately, the huge strike action today was stigmatized by this criminal act, which we condemn. This had nothing to do with actions of the union, and we will certainly continue our fight against these policies. We will take as many measures as possible to guard the protests in order to prevent such provocative acts.
And that was Ilias Fretakos. Well, Diana Maria Gariani is one of the protesters in Athens. She was at the demonstration this morning. She's at home now, joins us on the line. Diana, first of all, that attack on the bank, we heard there from Philip's suggestions that there were people involved who weren't really part of the major demonstrations, a fringe group. Is that your impression?
Could you repeat the question, please?
I'm saying the people who attacked the bank and burnt the bank... Philip Pangalos, one of the reporters there, was saying he didn't think they were part of the main demonstration. They were a kind of fringe group. Is that what you think?
Yes, that's correct. They are the known, unknown hooligans of the Greeks protesters, usually. Actually, the police do know them.
Do you think, though, when that kind of thing can happen in these kind of demonstrations, that it's a good idea to have protests like this in Athens?
Well, if we didn't protest, then nothing would go the way we need it should go. We can't be afraid always from these young hoodlums that they are by ruining every protest that the people, whether it is the public servants or the private sector, going into strike, to be afraid to go on a strike or to protest. Just because there is a bunch of hoodlums that they will ruin half of Athens.
But there was quite a lot of violence otherwise, wasn't there? A lot of fights between police and demonstrators, quite apart from what happened at the bank.
Actually, the sector that I was walking on, there was no fight, there was nothing in it. It was a very peaceful.
Do you think, though, Diana, that this is going to make much difference? I mean, you said you have to protest, but the Greek government, the socialist government, after all, is saying this must happen, there is no other way.
Oh, yes, there is another way. There is a lot of other ways, actually. And they don't want to do it. For starters, when our government already sold us out in loans, they can return all the stolen money that they have stole. They also, we have petrol, which we cannot use. We have gold that we are not allowed to use or to export it or to take it out. We have a lot of riches in Greece, but we are not allowed to use them. So the government actually should see a different way out, not to sell us out in the first place, not to cut our salaries for reasons that they want, and practically their own salaries in the government, whether it is the Prime Minister or the MP, MPs, their salaries are not cut down at all.
OK, Diana, thanks for joining us there. Diana Maria Gariani, one of the protesters involved in Athens today. Well, let's hear now from the government, or at least one of the government politicians. Annie Podimata is a member of the European Parliament for Greece's ruling party, PASOK. On the line to Brussels a little earlier, I got her reaction to what had happened in Athens today.
Well, first of all, I would like to express my sorrow for the tragic events in Greece that costed the life of three innocent people. What I would like to stress is that this tragic incident does not reflect the spirit of the tens of thousands of people, of citizens that demonstrated peacefully in the streets of Athens, protesting for the most severe austerity program that has ever been applied in a country member of the European Union.
Well, they may not have been in sympathy with the violence, but they clearly are not in sympathy with the policies of your party at the moment and the government.
Yes, and I can tell you that I can understand that, and I think that it's a bit normal when people face important cuts in their income, in their salaries, even in their pensions. It's fully understandable that they're not happy with it. I'm not happy with this. No one is happy. My government is not happy. The thing is that we are all aware that we do not have an alternative today at the point that we have arrived.
But the protesters clearly don't think there is an alternative. The protesters clearly think that this can be avoided. That's why they're protesting.
The big majority of Greek citizens are aware that there is no alternative. Those who protest are mainly those that have to submit this very, very important cuts in their salaries and in their pensions. So that's why I'm telling you that under a certain point I can understand the feeling of these people. And I can assure you that this anger, the feeling of protest, does not mean that they won't do what they have to do, what we all have to do. That means to implement properly and on time the program that has been adopted.
But can they implement it properly when it seems they can't even maintain order in their own capital? Three people die in a fire in the middle of a demonstration. It's not a very good indication of the control that the government has.
This is a tragic incident, and you're right, but I think that it doesn't mean that we're not able to keep the order. You know, there was a huge manifestation today in Athens streets, so some extremists took part in this in the march with their faces covered. This is something that I condemn severely, but has happened again in my country. So a bunch of people with their faces covered are proceeding to extremist acts. They're burning banks, they're burning cars, they're burning magazines. Some of them have been arrested, and I'm sure that the authorities will do what they have to do in order to be able to appoint the responsibles, the ones that have the responsibility for the tragic event that happened today in Athens.
Annie Podimata of Greece's ruling party PASOK. Well, joining me now live is Liana Kanelli, an MP with Greece's Communist Party. Liana, I know you don't approve of the programme of cuts the government's putting forward, but do you think protests like today that ended as they did are a good idea?
Look, the protesters cannot be guessing what's going to happen. Although this was a pre-announced event, protesters were threatened about a week ago that there are bad things that are going to happen. And they happened. If you have somebody threaten that there is blood that has to be shed, then, my dear, I think that lots of Britons will lose the opportunity of having beautiful vacation in Greece. It's a plan. It's a deliberated
killing. Whose plan? Who's making these threats?
It's a deliberated killing. We've got voices of the extreme rightist part that they are helping the socialists now to pass these measures. We have a very peculiar political situation that would be called just a few years ago or a few years after today that we're speaking, that's nationalistic plus Nazi style.
So you're saying these people actually deliberately engineered what happened today?
Exactly. They have announced it. They've been cultivating this climate for about a week because they were afraid that lots of people that didn't move their asses from their couches, they would go out. We've got old people that they get a pension of €400 and they're cut in half.
Liana, we're going to have to end it there. I'm so sorry, but thank you for joining us. Liana Kanelli there, an MP with Greece's Communist Party, talking about the protests in Athens today at those savage public spending cuts being imposed. Well, the upheavals over Greece's financial crisis, as we heard, did turn nasty today. Coming up later in the programme, we're going to hear about India's Supreme Court banning the use of truth drugs, lie detectors and brain scans on non-consenting suspects.
It's an extraordinary judgment and it's final on issues of principle, so you can't make a law to overrule a Supreme Court judgment. I'm so happy today to have these three tests go out of the window, so to speak.
That's coming up later in the programme. But other headlines at the moment. President Obama's administration says it favours an increase in penalties on oil polluters. And also, in the last few hours, politicians in Britain are making a last push for votes just before the opening of the general election. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. I'm Roger Hearing. Now, in the state of Louisiana in the southern United States, clearly they're dealing with the oil leak that's coming from the Gulf of Mexico is becoming extremely difficult for them. It's hoped the 100-ton oil container being engineered by BP, that's the company controlling or that controlled the rig, will plug the leak, but nothing like this has been done before. BP admits they can't be sure it's even going to work. The oil slick is a painful reminder to the American people and those elsewhere of the costs of reliance on oil. You might think now that the people whose environment's being threatened might be thinking differently about the oil industry that caused the catastrophe. But not much so far, at least in Louisiana, a state that is heavily reliant on its natural resources, as Andrew Bomford reports.
Driving down Highway 23 to Venice, Louisiana, you pass huge oil refineries, ugly testament to the power of oil. But this is also one of the most productive fishing grounds in the US, and there are nationally important wildlife reserves. How do these conflicting interests get along? Well, just fine, it seems, up till now.
So today, I got a call from BP. And they want us to go to work to clean up the oil spill.
Ricky Blink's getting his oyster boat ready for a new job, laying out booms to try and keep the oil off the coastline.
And they told us to prepare our boats, and then they would call us with further instruction.
The funny thing is, he was going to do it anyway, whether or not he got the job offer from BP. Ricky's something of an environmental activist and has already planted thousands of cypress trees in the marshes to try and stop coastal erosion.
Because this is my home. This is where I lived all my life. If you could just watch this, it could kill you. And this is a very important place for this country, and it's often overlooked.
Ricky's one of many around here who combines fishing with oil industry work. His other job is to ferry workers out to the oil rigs offshore.
Well, you know, I have a great job. It's very stable, and a good paycheck. It's been good to me so far. When our environment suffers, though, it's very upsetting.
And that's the dilemma that many are debating right now.
I'm Joan Strohmeyer from the Lighthouse Lodge in Venice, Louisiana, that little bitty city that we finally got alive.
The event that's put Venice on the map has also filled Joan Strohmeyer's hotel with cleanup workers and journalists. Joan's a businesswoman who's used to dealing with crises, including the complete destruction of her hotel after Hurricane Katrina. Joan knows very well the role of oil for the area and beyond.
Underneath here runs the gas and the oil that feeds people and cools their homes and cooks their food, brings their children to school. That's where our economy is built, is the oil and the gas and the seafood. I know a lot of fishermen here who would be very disappointed if we were to lose that, because they would lose an economy that they're bringing to this area.
The fishing grounds are closed, but most of Louisiana's oyster beds are open. So this important part of the local economy is still functioning, at least for now. John Tesvich speaks for the industry and says after all this is over, there may need to be a reassessment of how oil gets along with everyone else, because they've been very much the dominant partner. He's looking to the future.
In the long term, fisheries, when they're sustainable, they will be here 100 and 200 years from now. I don't think the fossil fuels will necessarily be as big a component.
Well, there might not be any oil.
Right, exactly. So what will sustain our coastal communities in 50 and 75 years from now?
Right now I'm taking all the oyster sacks off the boat so we can have room for as much boom as possible.
Ricky knows where his priorities are right now, the big cleanup. But he is a most pragmatic environmentalist.
This oil has to come from somewhere. And a lot of people, they like... Not in my backyard. Well, it has to be in somebody's backyard because their car, it doesn't run off of happiness and sunshine just yet. It runs off of gasoline. And that black stuff comes out the ground. People tend to look the other way.
From the helicopters taking off from here to serve the offshore oil rigs to these great tankers lying here on the Mississippi River, everyone here, the fishing industry, oil, even the lovers of the environment and the wildlife here, seem to have found a way to get along with each other quite nicely. You know, they all know that 30% of the nation's energy flows in through this particular place, and of course they all know how important that is. So I wonder how that oil slick out there is going to affect this consensus.
Andrew Bomford reporting from Louisiana. But there are those who think the spill raises grave questions about the future of oil drilling in the Gulf. And one of them is Aaron Viles of the Gulf Restoration Network, who joins us now live from New Orleans. Aaron, we're getting a few reports coming in now with, I think, a BP executive saying as many as 60,000 barrels a day could flow out if what they're trying to do at the moment doesn't work. But the Coast Guard saying at the moment it doesn't look like the oil spill is moving and it's unlikely to close shipping lanes. I gather you've actually flown over that quite recently.
Yeah, so we flew over this morning and actually took a look at the spill, the size of it, the extent of it. We saw that it had, in fact, oiled some of our barrier islands, some very important bird habitat areas are, you know, very close to receiving oil. So we're really terrified about the environmental impacts of this spill as it spreads across the north-central Gulf of Mexico, reaching really almost as far as Florida right now.
But it's interesting from Andrew Bomford's report just then, it does seem people in the area aren't that opposed to the whole future of oil exploration there. I mean, do you think that it's practical to continue to explore for oil and drill for oil there?
I think that there are certain areas of this nation that have made energy sacrifice zones, and the Gulf of Mexico certainly is one of those areas. Louisiana has kind of made its peace with that fact. Our politicians have made their careers off of that reality. And if you look at the Louisiana political establishment, by and large, they're still chanting, drill, baby, drill. Sorry about the 11 dead workers, but drill, baby, drill.
And on ordinary people, we heard there in Andrew Bomford's report, seem to feel the same.
Absolutely. We have seen the industry, the fishing industry is very intertwined with the oil and gas industry down here. When it's not shrimp season, a lot of folks will go off and actually work for the rigs, or when the price of shrimp drops too much, they'll work for the rigs, or when the, you know, the boom-bust cycle of oil and gas exploration is in a bust, they'll often go back to shrimping full-time. So there's a lot of overlap between the two industries, and by and large, folks want to just pay their bills.
So what's the downside, then?
The downside is this spill. The downside is that we're losing our wetlands at a staggering rate here in Louisiana. Even though we have 40% of the nation's coastal wetlands, we have 80% of the nation's coastal wetlands loss. About half of that acre an hour that we're losing, is directly attributable to oil and gas activity in our coastal marshes, the canals they've dredged, and the pollution they leave behind. We know there are spills every single year. It's not just this is the one. This is the one that's gotten the nation's media and the international media attention because it's so large. But in the last 10 years, there have been at least 172 spills of over 2,000 gallons in the Gulf of Mexico.
But how do you make any difference? You're on a hiding nothing. The people don't want to change. The state government doesn't want to change. I mean, you're not going to stop drilling, are you?
Well, I don't expect us to stop drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. What I expect us to do is really learn from this horrific example and put into place some effective safeguards. What we've been shown here clearly is that there's no plan B when a blowout preventer valve fails. Research shows unfortunately that in these ultra deep water depths that they are at, blowout preventer valves might fail as often as 50% of the time. So the idea that we have no effective skimming and containment cleanup technology in the surface of the Gulf is frightening.
Aaron, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks very much. Aaron Viles there of the Gulf Restoration Network talking about that spill in the Gulf, which, as the news is coming in, suggesting hasn't moved very much in the last few hours. But we'll keep you posted on further developments on that here on NewsHour. Coming up on NewsHour in the next 30 minutes, why did the man accused of attempting to bomb New York nearly get away? Also, why success doesn't bring popularity for the bright star of Wall Street?
Hey, hey, Goldman Sachs, time to give our money back!
And electric cars, too silent to be safe, so what should they sound like? Now, a summary of the latest world news.
BBC News with David Austin. The president of Greece, Karolas Papoulias, has said his country is on the edge of the abyss after violent protests over government spending cuts left three people dead. The president said it was the responsibility of all Greeks not to take a step into the void. The three dead were inside a bank in Athens, which was set on fire by a petrol bomb. The political leaders of the Eurozone have spoken out to defend the stability of their common currency, the euro, amid the problems in Greece. As the euro hit a one-year low against the dollar, the French Prime Minister said it was being targeted by financial speculators, but warned them they would fail. The White House in Washington has said it would back the idea of significantly raising the existing $75 million limit that oil companies must pay to clean up oil slicks like the one in the Gulf of Mexico. However, the White House spokesman did not say if President Obama supported the measure currently being discussed in Congress, which would raise that limit to $10 billion. On the last day of campaigning before the British general election, the leaders of the three main parties have been travelling across the country to try to win over undecided voters. Opinion polls put the main opposition Conservative Party of David Cameron ahead, but suggest he won't win an outright majority. Volcanic ash from Iceland has again been disrupting air traffic in parts of Europe. Hundreds of flights were cancelled as the authorities grounded aircraft in Scotland, Northern Ireland and the Irish Republic. Somali pirates have hijacked a large tanker loaded with oil bound for China. The Russian-owned vessel was seized about 900 kilometres off the Somali coast. Officials of the Commonwealth Games Federation have expressed concern about India's readiness for the Games in October. The chief executive officer for the Games said that a lot of progress had been made in recent months, but there was still a lot to do. And that's the latest BBC News.
You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. I'm Roger Hearing. Now, as the man accused of trying to set off a car bomb in the heart of New York continues to be questioned by US security officials, concerns growing about how near Faisal Shahzad came to leaving the country. He was arrested on board a plane about to leave for Dubai on Monday night. The New York Times says two crucial lapses allowed Mr. Shahzad to get onto the aircraft even though he was on a no-fly list. Well, Scott Shane is the Washington reporter with the New York Times and joins me now. Scott, first of all, what were these security lapses that you've been focusing on?
Well, the first one was that the FBI did a relatively quick job of identifying the man who had purchased this SUV, which was loaded with explosives. And they got his name on Sunday night, went looking for him, and actually found him. At some point on Monday, we think maybe early afternoon on Monday, and they put him under surveillance. But at some point in the afternoon, they lost track of him, and therefore they were unaware that he had traveled to JFK Airport in New York to board a flight to Dubai. So even though they had put his name on the no-fly list at about 12:30 in the afternoon and had him under surveillance, first they lost him, and then the second thing that happened was the airline, Emirates Airline, failed to check as it requested for an update to the no-fly list, and therefore it went ahead and sold him a ticket about 7:30 in the evening.
So they had the information, or they didn't have the information at that stage that he was on a no-fly list?
Well, apparently what happens is that normally these lists are updated regularly, and airlines are supposed to check every 24 hours. In this case, around 12:30 on Monday, a special electronic message was sent out to all the airlines saying an important name had been added to the no-fly list and that everyone should check. And apparently Emirates failed to do that, and therefore they were using an outdated no-fly list when they sold him the ticket and he was allowed to board.
I suppose one should say in the end, of course, they did pick him up from the flight before the flight left, so in that sense the system in the end worked, but you're saying it couldn't very nearly not have done.
Well, absolutely. I mean, what of course officials here have emphasized with some justification is that they managed to get a name, locate the individual, and arrest him in quite short order, 53 hours, and that by all measures that was a success. These other questions really are important for trying to tweak the system and improve it. And in fact, today they've announced that they're directing airlines to check for new names at least within 2 hours of getting a contact.
But the other part of this, the surveillance operation, I suppose that does just kind of happen. Sometimes you're tracking someone and you lose them.
Absolutely.
And there's not much they can do about that. That's just human error.
That's exactly right. Okay. Although the consequences in this case, you know, could have been presumably quite severe if he wasn't trying to board a plane but was in fact going off to use a bomb or a gun against other targets.
Okay, Scott, thanks very much. Scott Shane there of the New York Times. Well, more details have been coming out about Faisal Shahzad, the man arrested. He's 30, a naturalized US citizen who was born to a prominent family in Pakistan, and he lived in Connecticut in the US. He got a degree in America, a job as a junior financial consultant. He married, had two children, and bought a house there. The New York Times reports that he ran into financial trouble and returned to Pakistan last year for a while before then coming back to America again. So what can be read into that experience? What may have caused him, for example, to consider doing what he said to have tried to do in New York on Saturday night? Well, joining me now is John Esposito, Professor of Religion and International Affairs at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., and author of the book Who Speaks for Islam. Professor Esposito, this profile, and obviously we're piecing it together at the moment, is it fairly typical for someone alleged to have done this kind of thing?
Well, when you think about it, after the 9/11 attacks, within weeks, people initially were shocked when they actually looked at the profile of many of the hijackers and realized that they weren't that they were people who kind of were well educated, came from more establishment type backgrounds, that they weren't simply people who were living on the margins of society. If you look at Al Qaeda and you think of people not only like bin Laden, who came from a wealthy family, but his number two, Ayman al-Zawahiri, who's a surgeon and came from a prominent family. So it shouldn't be that surprising.
And the man who tried to set off a bomb, of course, over Detroit on Christmas Day, a Nigerian, again, from a very prominent family in Nigeria. The pattern fits, doesn't it?
That's right. That's right. We see it, if you actually think about it historically, when you look at social movements, for example, the Vietnam War, the anti-Vietnam situation, or the civil rights movement in America, people who belonged to those movements were not only people who were, as it were, you know, the personal victims or involved, for example, African-Americans or people who were subject to be drafted, but often they were people who were simply people who were concerned about and outraged by what they saw was an immoral war, a socially unjust situation, and often people who chose to become involved in these actions.
But interesting that point about Faisal Shahzad. It's not absolutely confirmed yet, but the suggestion that in this instance he perhaps lost his home in part of the financial crisis, fell on bad times. Can that sort of thing be a trigger to someone who has become part of a society then to perhaps turn against that society?
Well, I think that, I mean, I don't know. I can't get inside his mind, but I don't think that it would be the impact of the economy. I mean, what it can be is that he did go back to Pakistan, and depending on how he was looking at, in general, and seeing the situation in recent years in terms of America's role overseas, you know, there are those who are very supportive of our role, and there are others, and certainly many in the Muslim world, who worry about the extent to which the U.S. goes into countries, you know, and are concerned about intervention, occupation. And so, you know, you look at Iraq, you look at Afghanistan, and you look more recently at the heating up of the movement in Pakistan. While some in Pakistan welcome this kind of intervention, there are others who look at the so-called collateral damage and I think become radicalized. You certainly have had people in the UK who have been of Pakistani background and in fact have become radicalized as they see or perceive the action that's taking place in places like Pakistan.
Professor Esposito, thank you very much indeed. John Esposito there of Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. So, after 29 days of what commentators are saying is one of the strangest elections in modern British history, the politicians and pollsters, the commentators and the canvassers will all have to shut up in just under 3 hours' time and let the people speak. In a moment, we'll try to size up the campaign, but first, a little reminder of the sounds of a very singular few weeks in UK politics.
And listen, what none of this is going to make any difference if we allow this this rotten system in Westminster to carry on, where MPs have jobs for life, where they basically only need to get 20-30% of your votes in their
areas. You've just watched that. You've heard the Prime Minister's words in the Sky News truck. What is your instant reaction to that?
I mean, very upsetting. I'm very upset.
Did you expect that from him?
No.
A microphone picked you up saying that was a very bigoted woman. Is that what you said?
I apologise if I've said anything like that. What I think she was raising with me was an issue about immigration and saying that there were too many people from Eastern Europe in the country. And
I'm the son of a Church of Scotland minister. He taught me, my father, that life was about more than self-interest, that work is about more than self-advancement, that service is about more than self-service, that happiness is about more than what you earn and own. My parents taught me the fundamental values of taking responsibility, doing your duty, being honest, looking out for others, and that is the right way. It is your way and it is my way.
It is profoundly misguided. I mean, Nick has talked, not tonight, but has talked about 600,000 people having this amnesty, being able to stay, and they would be able to bring over a relative each. So that's 1.2 million potentially. And all those people would have access to welfare and to housing. I think this could make
us... Why don't we save time?
This could make the...
Why don't we save some time?
Will you explain the number then?
Why don't we save time? Instead of making endlessly misleading comments, you know, let's just save time and assume every time you talk about our policy, it's just wrong. What I'm saying is...
And there you heard, of course, Nick Clegg, you heard Gordon Brown, and, of course, you heard David Cameron, the leaders of the three major parties in the election. Well, joining me now is our political correspondent, Rob Watson, who's been travelling across the country, following every twist and turn in this campaign. So, Rob, I said it's been a peculiar, strange campaign. I mean, what has made it so strange and peculiar?
Well, I've got to say, first of all, Roger, I did feel slightly nostalgia for the last few weeks just hearing that montage there. It brought back a lot of memories. Well, I think it's been very strange because it just hasn't fitted the original script, if I could put it that way. If you'd asked all of the commentators, even the politicians a couple of months ago, what would this campaign have looked like? They would have said, well, it's going to be a referendum on 13 years of Labour government and almost certainly a referendum they will lose, with the Conservatives ending up the likely winner, in large part because just the longevity of the government and problems with the economy, such as the enormous budget deficit. I think people would have also said the campaign is going to be greeted with a sigh of total indifference from the voters because of the whole disillusion surrounding the MP's expenses scandal. Well, the script has been altered very dramatically, in large part, of course, because of those television debates that we were hearing of. And they did two things, really, didn't they? They instilled a certain excitement into the campaign that nobody thought would be there. Most importantly, perhaps, though, they gave a boost to the third party, the Liberal Democrats, suddenly turning this into a three-horse race.
And a prospect, in consequence, of possibly a hung parliament. I mean, who knows? But a parliament where no clear party is clearly in charge.
Absolutely. All one can go on, and I'm always super cautious, and you might say a little bit overcautious about this, but one does tend to stick to the evidence of the opinion polls. And yes, they suggest that while the Conservatives do have a pretty healthy lead, it's not by enough, given the vagaries of Britain's parliamentary system, to get an outright majority. Now, that may all be wrong, because something else that this campaign has thrown up, going back to your original question of it being so odd, is this the huge volatility. I mean, some polls are being told that as many as 40%, it seems incredible, of the electorate still haven't made up their minds and will only do so when their little pencils hover over the box where to put their crosses.
Rob, thanks very much indeed. They only have a few more hours, of course, to go before they need to make up their minds about that. And the campaign, of course, will end. And we will, of course, be covering the results here on the BBC World Service. Do stay tuned for that coming up in the next 24 to 48 hours. And it may, of course, go longer than that if the results are ones that need then to be parlayed into some kind of negotiations over a hung parliament, as we were saying there with Rob. Well, let's move now to India, where the Supreme Court's made a landmark ruling banning the forcible use of truth drugs and lie detectors by police on criminal suspects. Up to now, the evidence from such procedures has been used in courts and resulted in many convictions. But human rights groups have said the practices amount to torture. Colin Gonsalves is founder of India's Human Rights Law Network, and he told me he's really pleased with his latest judgment.
It's an extraordinary judgment. The narco analysis were being routinely performed on accused persons, and the police were leaking bits and pieces of so-called evidence to the press, saying that, you know, a person confessed under narco analysis to this crime and that crime and so on. And there was gross misuse of this very spurious kind of test. It's almost like voodoo science where you inject a truth serum into the body and the person is supposed to speak the truth after that and disclose all his innermost secrets and so on.
And this is involuntary. But people don't have a choice. They hold them down and inject this drug into them.
That's right. And it was very sad to see courts upholding this kind of practice. It's a most barbaric practice. And I'm told in some jurisdictions, it's even described as torture because there's a considerable amount of pain experienced by the person who is injected with this drug. So that's one thing as far as narco analysis is concerned, which has been used by the police in many, many trials. That will now come to an end. That's one. The second is the lie detector tests, which were being routinely done forcibly again on accused persons and very funny kinds of contrived results produced in courts and convictions obtained based on these kind of tests. So that will come to an end. And brain mapping, of course.
Brain mapping? What's that?
Brain mapping is something where they put a certain instrument to your head and they ask you certain questions. And even if you keep quiet, apparently there's some reaction that goes on and this kind of instrument picks up the signals. And so even though you're silent, that data can be analyzed and very damning evidence apparently, you know, used against you. And the Bombay High Court in a very recent case said that it's not an invasion of your privacy because we're not asking you to speak. They're just attaching, you know, certain things to your head. So it's perfectly legal. And that was a shocking decision of the Bombay High Court, which was pending in the Supreme Court. So all these barbaric practices will, I think, now stop.
According to some things I've read, there's some doubt that evidence from these was actually admissible anyway up to now.
Well, it was thought of as admissible. The police were using it routinely in investigations. I believe that there were many courts that relied on this kind of evidence, either to corroborate the substantial evidence or otherwise. So it was very pervasive in the criminal justice system, and it created a huge crisis of confidence in the evidence being produced.
But the Supreme Court judgment, as I understand it, doesn't actually ban the use of these things altogether, does it?
Yeah. I believe, because the judgment is just out, I believe it says it could be voluntarily undertaken by accused persons. Now, that's a huge mistake, I think, in the judgment, because if something is wrong, it's wrong. You can't really make it right by agreeing to it. And in a country like India, where people are so poor and illiterate, to get a signature on a piece of paper saying, look, I agree to the narco analysis or the lie detector is very, very easy. I don't think the Supreme Court should have left that loophole open at all in this case.
But people might say, well, come on, this is just a way of finding, perhaps scientifically finding out, the potential for guilt or further evidence in a case. I mean, if someone were murdered and it was a way of finding out who'd murdered them, surely it's a good idea, isn't it?
I think evidence right across the world shows that the lie detector, the narco test, the brain mapping, it's very unreliable, it's very unpredictable, there's no scientific basis. So for a criminal trial, really, it messes up things completely.
And that was Colin Gonsalves, founder of India's Human Rights Law Network, talking to me about that landmark judgment by the Indian Supreme Court banning the forcible use of truth drugs and lie detectors by police on criminal suspects. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London. Now, a reminder of today's main news. There have been violent protests against the Greek government's austerity plans, which have left three people dead. Earlier we heard universal condemnation of the deaths in Greece. A member of the European Parliament from Greece's ruling Socialist Party also sympathised with the protesters.
I think that it's a bit normal when people face important cuts in their income, in their salaries, even in their pensions. It's fully understandable that they're not happy with it. I'm not happy with this. No one is happy. My government is not happy. The thing is that we are all aware that we do not have an alternative today at the point that we have arrived.
Other headlines. President Obama's administration says it favours an increase in penalties on oil polluters. And as we heard, politicians in Britain are making a last push for votes in the final hours before the general election. You're listening to NewsHour with me, Roger Hearing. Now, financial reform is the hot topic in Washington and on Wall Street. At the heart of the debate is how to regulate the massive market for derivatives, complicated financial mechanisms which many blame for the crisis. One bank which keeps popping up in the debate is Goldman Sachs, which has seen its shares fall by nearly a fifth since it was charged with fraud last month by the US financial watchdog, the Securities and Exchange Commission. Since then, Goldman executives have been given a pretty rough time by US legislators, and the banks are facing a number of lawsuits on the way they conduct their business. In many ways, Goldman has been the most obvious Wall Street survivor of this crisis, so how will it be now affected now by the plans for reform? The BBC's Matt Prodger has been finding out.
Hey, hey, Goldman Sachs, time to give our money back! Hey, hey, Goldman Sachs, time to give our money back!
Main Street marching on Wall Street. Thousands of protesters demanding banking reform. They're up in arms about how easily rich banks have been able to put their hands into the public purse. Not least Goldman Sachs. And it's not just protesters who are angry. Michael Greenberger was a financial regulator under the Clinton administration in the 1990s.
Events of 2008 emanated from a $600 trillion highly unregulated market that was completely opaque to the world's regulators. If you can rid the market of that kind of toxicity, we can look forward to a period of relative calm in our financial markets.
To do that, he says, Congress needs to regulate the financial instruments which, above all, were responsible for that crash. A kind of designer derivative known as over-the-counter derivatives, the market for which is 20 times the size of the American economy. Mark Williams, a former trader who advises big banks on risk, says it is these derivatives which have made huge profits for Goldman Sachs.
Derivatives are central to their strategy. They're able to sit at the very top of information flow on Wall Street at that main intersection and buy and sell derivatives. Goldman itself has seen this opportunity to use derivatives to hedge in regard to trading, not only selling these derivatives, getting a fee, but also taking positions using their capital to profit.
But such instruments can also be destructive. They can be used to bet against corporations, countries like Greece, even currencies like the euro. And there's a drive to regulate them. Publicly, Goldman Sachs says it supports reform. Arthur Levitt used to head the Wall Street watchdog, the SEC, in the 1990s when he resisted attempts to regulate derivatives. With banking regulation now in Barack Obama's sights, Mr. Levitt is now working as an advisor to Goldman Sachs.
They'll satisfy the public, which is lusting for revenge, but they certainly won't prevent another meltdown of the kind that we've seen. They certainly won't address the central core issue of stupid lending policies. They certainly won't address the governance issues, which are so fundamental to protecting investor interests.
But Goldman is seen as having far too much influence on Washington as it is. Former Goldman executives peppered the Obama administration. The Treasury Secretary who led the bailout, Henry Paulson, is a former Goldman CEO. Congressman Alan Grayson is scathing about the supposed wisdom of inviting those who have been at the heart of the mess into the heart of the solution.
Well, that's an interesting concept. Maybe we should put felons in charge of prisons. How about that? Maybe we should have Al-Qaeda members as flying in the United States as pilots. How about that, too? This country was brought to the brink of national disaster and national bankruptcy on account of the financial system and failures of the financial system. And none of these people who caused this have been held responsible for it, neither in Washington nor in Wall Street.
Goldman Sachs is under siege politically, legally, and in the court of public opinion. It survived the crisis, but its recovery since then has provoked a storm that's hard to weather.
Matt Prodger, and you can hear more of that report on Goldman Sachs on this week's Assignment programme on the BBC World Service. Now, electric cars, we're told, are the future. The big car makers around the world have been rushing to bring out models for a growing market in cars run by rechargeable batteries, which are increasingly popular because of rising oil prices and environmental concerns. And of course, the vehicles don't make the same noise that combustion engines make. In fact, they don't make any noise at all. And that can be a problem. People crossing the road normally use their ears to tell them if traffic's coming. With an electric car, they don't hear it coming. So now, a group of scientists at Warwick University here in the UK are looking into creating artificial noise for these cars. Now, here are a few possibilities. Now, I'm sure well-attuned World Service listeners will know that was the sound variously of white noise, a sports car, a waterfall, and it says here pod racers from the Star Wars films. Well, Paul Jennings is Professor of Experiential Engineering at Warwick, and he's leading the research team. But when I spoke to him, I said, isn't a quiet car really actually quite a good thing?
I think it is a good thing, yes. As you say, noise can be very annoying, and traffic noise can be also go right out to health effects in urban environments. However, I think what we often do, even by describing it as noise rather than sound, is to maybe overemphasise the negative aspects. I think it's also a positive aspect, the fact that it's a warning that there's a large metal object coming in your direction.
Have there actually been incidents where people, because they can't hear them, have got knocked over?
Recently, there has been some statistics published by the NHTSA, that's the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration in North America, to show a slight increase in the number of accidents with cyclists and pedestrians from use of hybrid vehicles.
What do you do? I mean, do you just say, well, let's what's a reasonably nice car noise, let's dub it and then somehow introduce it into the electric?
Well, I think there's some conflicting interests here, that we need to be careful that we have a warning for pedestrians, but at the same time we don't want to lose the benefits for the urban environment. There's actually a third party that are interested as well. We've worked for many years looking at how to optimise the interior sound of vehicles, and we know that the manufacturers recognise that the sound of their vehicles conveys a lot about their brand. If you imagine you had a sports car that was silent, maybe that wouldn't give you the same sort of feeling about your car.
But when you're going on the school pickup, you don't actually want a Ferrari noise, do you, inside
no,
or out?
No, it's absolutely. It's having the best sound for the usage.
Do you think you do need to introduce artificial sound?
I think we should certainly be exploring that. There are lots of sounds being considered. The sounds maybe from science fiction. What you have to make sure is that the sound is recognisable as an oncoming car. But also, we know that, for instance, natural sounds, water sounds, have a pleasing aspect to them. People often find sitting near water features as relaxing. I think in the end, it would be nice if the manufacturers had flexibility in the sort of sounds that they could create, such that they could represent the brand in a positive way. I think it's really important we shouldn't lose any of the potential benefits to the environment, which are huge with the potential reduction of sound from electric vehicles, but at the same time, it's that compromise with the safety for pedestrians.
What about you, Professor Jennings? You get a new electric car. It's got no sound at the moment, and they say, look, we can give you anything you want. What do you want?
That's actually quite a challenging question. I think at the moment I would be interested to put on a sound that was maybe a little bit radically different but proven to be safe.
Give me an example. What would you like? You know, you've got the choice now. Is it going to be a waterfall? Is it going to be the Starship Enterprise? A Ferrari? What would you like?
I think I would like to have a car that you were able to create different sounds for.
Professor Paul Jennings, he just wasn't going to tell me, was he? But we do want to hear from you. What do you think would be the ideal, ultimate sound for a car, an electric car that you choose? And it's amazing to be able just to choose whatever noise it makes. So please let us know your thoughts. You can go on our website, of course. You can go to our Facebook website as well. And you can go and tell us on email, which is worldhaveyoursay@bbc.com. worldhaveyoursay@bbc.com. I suppose you could have a car that makes the sound of the News Hour theme. That would be rather menacing coming towards you as you're crossing the road. There's a thought. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.